my head. Then I wrapped myself around a suitably heavy rock and waved off a couple of fish that were trying to nibble scraps off my face. The adventurers were already there, running back and forth along the beach, searching for me. One of them, probably Benjamin, thundered his way along the pier. He stopped, flustered, at a railing directly above me, and glanced down. I screwed my eyes shut and chanted inside my head, hoping he would move on. I am a crab. I am thinking crabby thoughts. I am tightening my grip on this rock with my big red pincers. Eventually, I heard him stomp sullenly back the way he came, and I relaxed the crab mindset. As I did so, a new thought arose. Why didn't I just give myself up? Things had been so hectic lately that I had almost lost sight of my actual goal. If Barry was working for the Deleters, and the Deleters were enforcing some glorious plan for the world that demanded my removal, they might just rub me out. But then there was the question Barry had refused to answer. Why were they making him demolish Yawnbore, rather than deleting it themselves? I still couldn't begin to grasp what exactly Barry and his ethereal sponsors were playing at. And then there was the fact that he had sawed my foot off. The point was quickly becoming moot, as the adventurers had regrouped on the beach, abandoning the search. They came to some worried consensus, then disappeared back into the town. I was in no hurry to surface. I rearranged myself on my rock, brushed off some confused and amorous female crabs, and tried to come up with a plan. 7 plans later, I noticed with a start that the sun had gone down. The thing about being undead is that without the usual human naggings of sleep, food, and air, it's easy to lose track of time when you're deep in thought. Doubly so when you're being distracted by cold seawater and naughty fish. All I'd come up with was that I had to get to Lowlead, and since there were no ships docked in Yawnbore, I'd have to swim. It wouldn't be a very stimulating trip, and there would probably be a lot of sharks that might understandably confuse my body for chum, but there was no other option. The magic resistance would know what to do. I'd lost Drilda, so uncovering the mystery of her condition was on hold, but that was hardly my top concern at that point. No sense wasting time. I sat up. Then I kept right on going. At first I thought my pockets had split and disgorged their stones, but then I realized that the rock I had been sitting on was in fact a stout treasure chest, which was now connected to a grappling hook being hauled up from above. Overhead was the underside of a rowing boat, a stark black turd shape against the moonlight. I tried to get away, but by the time I figured out that the grappling hook had also snagged a big handful of my robe, my head was already breaking surface. In the darkness, I couldn't make out the occupants of the boat, but they didn't look like adventurers, or at least not like any of the ones I'd seen with Barry in Yawnbore. I decided to hope for the best and play dead, a role for which I had unmatched qualifications. "Don't remember this lad being here when we sent the chest down," said a gruff voice in a strong sailor accent. "Did we kill anyone last time we hit town? I can't remember. I was pretty drunk," said a slightly more refined voice.
"Hey, Slippery John knows this guy," said an extremely familiar voice. "How have you been? Slippery John was wondering where you ended up."
I kept my tongue firmly lolled.
"He's dead, Slippery John. He's not going to talk back," said the first voice.
No, he's not dead. Well, Slippery John means he is dead, but he still talks and moves around. Look, you can tell he's not properly dead because the corners of his mouth are twitching."
I gave up. "Look,
I said, prompting a yelp of fright from the two pirates. You could just throw me back and forget this ever happened. It would make all our lives a lot less complicated.
Slippery John was hoping Slippery John would run into you again, said Slippery John. He looked the same as always, but now he was wearing an eye patch, as was each of his two new friends. Wondering if that quest idea of yours is still open?
What quest idea?
That quest where Slippery John escorts you to Lowlead City. Slippery John's been onto some of Slippery John's contacts in the Suicide Squad, and they're really into the idea.
What Suicide Squad?
You know, the Magic Resistance, the Secret Council of Magicians who are investigating ways to end the Deleter Plague and restore death and entropy to the universe.
He looked at me in silence for a moment.
Slippery John is wondering if he should have said all that.
Wait. I jerked a thumb vaguely in the direction of the cacophony of demolition work coming from Yawnbore. You're not working for Barry? By now, the two pirates flanking Slippery John were over their initial shock at my reanimated status, and had drawn themselves to their full sitting height to look down at me through their nostril hairs. "The bloated rats don't work for no man but Cap'n Scar," said the one on the left. I was adjusting to the dark now, and could make out that he was in fact a bloated pirate with a ratty beard.
"Or First Mate Dodgy Bill, if Captain Scar's sick," added the other pirate,
who was thin and probably from a higher-class background, given that his blonde hair looked like it occasionally came within earshot of a comb.
"Or Second Mate Smiling Phil, if they're both out of it."
"Slippery John wouldn't work for Barry again," said Slippery John. "Maybe it's one of those strange thief senses at work, but I swear there's something a little bit odd about him now."
"A little bit, yes," I said irritably.
"Slippery John was trying to buy passage with these boys when he brought that barrier down."
"Yes, about that, we should be getting back to the ship," said the posher pirate. "Will you be coming along, mister?"
"I suppose so," I said with a sigh.
"First the fishing trip, now this," muttered the stout pirate as they took up the oars. "Why do we always get stuck with the smelliest loot?"
The Black Pudding was a small but well-armed affair with large numbers of cannons poking out from the top deck like seasick tourists. It was painted entirely black and was concealed from the eyes of Yawnbore in a cheeky little cove just around the bay. The moment I clambered up onto the deck, Slippery John's two escorts grabbed me by the shoulders and flung me onto my face. A gap-toothed cheer went up among the assembled crew.
"Ahar!" went a booming voice from above. "What have we here, my lads? Not much meat on him, is there? Maybe we should throw him to the sharks."
The crew cheered raucously, raising their cutlasses to the sky. Slowly I looked up. A pair of gigantic black boots came into view. They were followed by the tattered hem of a black woolen dress over a dense network of petticoats. My gaze continued travelling upwards until I could look the wearer in the eye.
"Ew,"
she said involuntarily as she took in my face.
"Looks like someone already did."
"We dredged him up from the bay, Cap'n Scar," said one of my handlers. "Apparently he's some new kind of dead where you get to be a bit alive and all."
Captain Scar was an enormous matronly woman, whose tattered old-fashioned dress appeared to be held together by a sword belt and bandolier. She reminded me very much of the senior dinner lady from my old school, who had once took on the entire school cricket team at tug-of-war. She hadn't won, obviously, but no one could deny that the woman had balls. Her pirate crew, every single one of whom was sporting eye patches, was certainly in awe of her. There were 20 of them clustered around the sides of the deck, giving her a wide berth as she stood with hands on hips. They watched with the terrified but respectful eyes of trapped zoo patrons, watching an escaped gorilla decide whose children to eat first.
"It's cool," said Slippery John, smiling fearlessly from behind his impenetrable shield of stupidity. "He's with Slippery John."
Captain Scar relaxed, and most of the crew began to sheath their cutlasses. All that jeering and threatening business had apparently been some kind of formality. I began. "Are you the ones who looted the hotel?"
"Saw that, did ye?" said Captain Scar proudly. "Did a nice bit of work on it, aye?"
She pumped her fist obscenely.
"Weren't very satisfying, though, like. Everyone just lay flat on their back and took it, and the spark just weren't there, you know? Sort of like me first marriage."
Up until then, I'd never been sure how one laughs uproariously, but Captain Scar demonstrated it beautifully. "I'm looking for passage to Lowlead," I said, rising up to my knees.
"Aye, well,"
said Captain Scar, before firing from the corner of her mouth a mass of chewing tobacco the size of my fist.
"You're gonna have trouble there. Firstly, we're not a sodding taxi service, and secondly, there's a barrier stopping us from leaving the bay."
"The magic barrier?"
"Aye, it extends a few hundred yards out to sea. We could sail right up to it, but at the last second we just get pushed away, sort of like me second husband."
She slapped me between the shoulder blades hard enough to rattle all my remaining teeth.
"We sail in for some shore leave and find everyone in the town's come over all weird. So we're about to pack up and go when that Barry lubber arrives with his catapult and puts his magic barrier up."
"It's a trebuchet," I said.
"No, it's not. It's a magic barrier. Don't be stupid. So he put it up and we've been stuck here for about a day. Hidden in the cove, mind. He doesn't know we're here yet."
"If I help you get past the barrier, can I get a ride to Lowlead?" Captain Scar stroked her chin. It was like watching someone caress a brick with a ham hock.
"You know anything about magic?"
"I'm a mage," I said, deciding not to reveal that I'd never technically graduated mage school and only knew four spells, two for combat, one for conjuring water, and one for dog grooming. Also, I can pass through the barrier.
"Oh, aye, and what makes ye so special?"
"Because I'm undead. I'm dead as far as the rules of nature and magic are concerned."
"Sounds like me third marriage."
I nimbly ducked as laughter broke out again, and a hand like a bag full of steaks swung through the air. Then she thought in silence for some time, stroking her impressive chin as her mental cogs turned.
"So,"
she said finally,
"how would you go about switching off the barrier?"
I put on my best expert voice. "Magic fields only turn off if the caster wills it, runs out of mana, falls unconscious, or dies."
"We could have figured that out, lad."
She snapped her fingers with a sound like a sausage striking a kettle drum.
"Nah, I've got a better idea. Why don't you just make us all undead?"
I said.
"Aye,"
said Scar, grinning excitedly and chewing a black thumbnail.
"If you make us all undead like ye, we'll all be able to go through the barrier."
"But we'll be undead forever," piped up a nameless pirate.
"We'll be ghost pirates,"
cried Scar. Some of the pirates looked at each other in confusion for a moment. Then the realization sank into their brains with a burst of childlike joy.
"We'll become legends,"
cried First Mate Dodgy Bill, leaping to his feet.
"They'll be scaring each other with stories of the ghost pirates across the 17 seas.
We'll set up base on an island with a big mountain shaped like a skull," went Vacuous David. "I'll cut the sails up so they look all shredded and scary-like," added Corpulent Neil.
We'll invade coastal towns and walk through walls and look at all the teenage daughters in their underpants, added smiling Phil.
This brought on a round of particularly lusty ahars. I can't walk through walls, I yelled over the growing chorus. It only silenced them for an instant.
I thought you said you could, said Phil.
Magic barriers. I said I can walk through magic barriers.
Then we'll walk through magic walls and look at all the wizard daughters.
Captain Scar silenced her excited crew with a single clap of her hands that violently blasted air into my face.
Right then, it's decided.
She pulled her lacy collar away from her massive neck.
Me first. Give us a quick bite. Not too hard. And don't worry, I won't get too attached.
She nudged me in the ribs. I stared at a large and prominent vein on her throat, which was thumping as if playful kittens were rolling around inside. No, this is extremely wrong. A noticeable darkening of mood signalled that I had just put my remaining foot in it. A subtle hiss of disapproval was running through the audience. Captain Scar covered her neck and drew herself up, nostrils flaring.
Do ye know what happened to the last man who said no to the bloated rats?
She said, levelly. You gave him a ride to Lowlead? I said, being a stupid bastard.
No.
We did, technically, said Dodgy Bill, helpfully.
Captain Scar grinned.
Oh, yeah, we sent him to Lowlead. Also, we sent him to a few other places, simultaneously, like. So ye might want to reconsider your position before we reconsider it for ye.
I reconsidered, but my position wasn't showing any improvement. I can't make you undead, I had to stop talking because a cutlass the size of a surfboard was pressing on my vocal cords. Instantly the rest of the pirates followed Captain Scar's lead and drew their swords with a deafening scrape of metal, until 20 lengths of sharpened steel were pointing at my heart. Slippery John sat on a nearby keg, cheerfully watching the drama unfold.
"So undeath's too good for the likes of us, is it, Fancy Pants?"
said Captain Scar, touchily. "It's just not transmittable by bite," I said, trying to move my Adam's apple as little as possible. "It doesn't work like that."
"Aye, all right," said Scar, reasonably. "Maybe we'll just chop you into bits and see if we can figure out how it does work."
I could see that honesty wasn't doing me any favours in this company. All right, I said, attempting to nudge the cutlass away with a fingertip. You have passed the test. Your insistence and base threats have proven you worthy of my, wondrous dark gift.
That's more like it,
grumbled Scar, withdrawing her sword. The pirates reluctantly followed suit, but kept their blades unsheathed in case I tried being difficult again.
Where do you want us?
Well, that's sort of the thing. It's a complicated process. I need to get hold of some reagents, some, dragon moss, and the eyes of a... I took a desperate glance around. Seagull.
Men!
Bellowed Captain Scar.
Take arms! We're going into town to loot the magic shops!
I displayed my palms and shook them before the aharas got too loud. No, wait! If you do that, Barry'll know we're here!
That's another 3 no's, laddie. You're walking a pretty fine line. It won't matter if he figures out we're here. We'll swipe what we need, leg it back to the ship, you work your oogie boogies and we'll be off.
The audience were getting more and more unruly the more times I tried to pull them back from a state of beard-chewing over-excitement. Yes, but we still wouldn't be able to pass through the barrier.
Why not?
Because... I looked down. The floor.
What?
The ship. The ship wouldn't be able to pass through. because it's made of wood. Organic. It's technically life. The barrier wouldn't let it through. They seemed to buy it. They put their pillaging sacks down and scratched their heads, thinking.
I suppose, said Scar, we could kill that vicar then, while we're there.
Relief flooded out of me like a burst of gas from a volcanic vent. I nodded as fast as I could, causing something to dislodge inside my skull and rattle around. And then you'll take me to Lowlead?
Suppose so. We were heading there anyway for Slippery John, and the music festival's coming up there soon.
Slippery John wants to take a quick look around the countryside before we go, piped up Slippery John, hopping onto his feet. Slippery John wants one last chance to look for Drilda. Drilda? I left her in a wheelbarrow on the way into town, I said, because my guard was down and I couldn't stop myself in time. What? She was with you? It was the first time I'd ever seen Slippery John genuinely angry, rather than just stupid or pleased with himself. What perversity have you been inflicting upon Slippery John's woman, villainous lich? I put my hands up as the swords came out again. I didn't do anything. I was just taking her to get her looked at. Since when is she your woman? She's Slippery John's fiancée. Slippery John asked her to marry him just before the Battle of Applewheat. And she said yes. He looked momentarily guilty. Sort of, in a fashion. Didn't say no, at any rate. He turned to Captain Scar. Slippery John has to go get her. Oh, come on, I said, determined to not take at least one person's bullshit today. We don't have time.
Maybe you don't know who you're dealing with, said Captain Scar, the cutlass finding my throat again. That's Slippery John, that is. King of the Lowlead Thieves. Slayer of the Necromancer Lord Dreadgrave.
Slippery John coughed.
And if he says we're going back for his woman, we're going back for his woman. Or to be more specific...
To be more specific, we were going back for his woman, as in Slippery John and me, alone, in the rowboat. Barry and his cult were distracted by their demolition work, so at least we wouldn't have to worry about them, assuming they had all recently undergone severe brain injuries. This was the plan. We'd land at the very end of the beach, far away from Barry and his crew, reunite with Drilda, and push her barrow around the force field to the cliffs north of town, where the Black Pudding could stop to pick it up once the barrier was off. When she was in position, I'd cast a firebolt into the night sky as a signal for the pirates to begin the assault. Unfortunately, it would also be a fairly obvious signal for the newly empowered Barry. So, creature of darkness, said Slippery John, after several minutes of rowing in awkward silence, when they were stitching your corpse back together, did they put the lungs in backwards? I treated him to a long, glowy-eyed stare. What? Slippery John was just wondering if that's how you got so good at talking out of your arse. The first stare went down so well I gave him another. You've been working on that for the last 20 minutes, haven't you? He was puffed up with triumph. You might be able to fool those grog-addled corsairs, but nothing slips past Slippery John. He leaned back, repulsively pleased with himself. Which is ironic when you think about it. The rowboat landed not far from where I'd first submerged myself, near the pier. In the distance, the creaking of a trebuchet alternated with the crunches and rattles of masonry in distress. Barry's crew were hard at work in the soon-to-be-not-so-high-rent suburbs in the south end of town. I immediately hopped out of the boat and began scraping up a fresh supply of shingle for my robe pockets. "What are you doing, undead?" said Slippery John. "I'm going to swim to Lowlead." "Why? There's a ship going there. Yes, and when the crew figure out that I can't make them into ghost pirates, they're going to fire all my body parts out of different cannons. Ah, that's just pirates. All mouth, no pantaloons. They'll forget all about it by the time we're out of the bay. Slippery John thinks you're being too hard on them, after they fitted you with that nice wooden leg, too. I kicked at the shingle bitterly. They broke it off of a stool, for God's sake. There's a splinter sticking right in my stump. And anyway, what about my quest? You said Slippery John could escort you to the suicide squad in Lowlead. I'll find them myself. And how are you going to do that, dead man? Ask directions. Saunter up to the front door and ask to speak to the manager. Think about it. If they gave their address out to any old time waster, the deleters would just find them and rub them out, yeah? They never use the same meeting location twice. When they want you to do quests for them, you have to put a bag on your head and have the details whispered to you from inside a toilet cubicle. There he was, standing smugly on the darkened beach, little arms folded, one little beady eye shining gleefully from behind his little moustache and pirate eye patch. It would have been so easy to stove his little chubby head in with a rock. All right, I said, sighing the dust out of my lungs. Let's just find your stupid catatonic girlfriend. The streets were deserted. Barry's thugs must already have picked up all the townsfolk. We made our way east through the maze of alleyways towards the main road where I'd entered the town. Slippery John insisted on darting stealthily from cover to cover, while I sulkily tromped down the middle of the roads. "So she just stopped moving?" he asked as we neared our destination. "Yeah," I said, deciding not to mention my part in Drilda's current condition. He clicked his tongue. "The final stage of the syndrome," he said sagely. "Did I tell you about that?" "You did, yes. So this whole mission is totally pointless. She's not going to be of any use to you."
"Slippery John doesn't see the point in explaining this to you, Corpse. You'd need things like feelings and actual human decency to understand. True love is blind to petty flaws like total catatonia."
"I get the impression you're hoping it'll be blind to a few other things, too. Anyway, there she is." We were back at the border of Yawnbore, and the featureless, hilly, utterly devoid of lunatics grasslands that surrounded the town had never looked more enticing. Drilda was exactly where I'd left her, half in and half out of an apple-wheat grocer's rusted wheelbarrow. Slippery John bounded up to her excitedly, smacked straight into unexpectedly solid thin air, and fell flat on his back. Meanwhile, I strolled through the barrier and idly took up the wheelbarrow handles. "Shall we?" Slippery John sat up, feeling his jaw for loose teeth. "Something's not right. Why is she all limp?" I picked up her wrist for a second. It dropped back down with a jangle of bracelets. "I thought that was the last stage of the syndrome. Isn't it?" "The last stage of the syndrome is supposed to make them stiffen up. They stand in a nonchalant macho pose with their legs apart and their chest thrust out forever. You want to make them sit or lie down, you have to break their knees with a mallet. They've never gone all floppy like that. Are you sure she's not just dead?"
I felt her.
"I don't know, she's pretty warm." Slippery John flinched, his hands pressed up against the invisible barrier like a gesture of placation.
"Slippery John would prefer it if you didn't put your hand there."
I glanced down, then back up. "What's Slippery John going to do about it?" He scowled from behind the invisible wall.
"Why do you feel you have to antagonize me, servant of evil?"
A beat.
"Actually, Slippery John sort of answered his own question there."
A loud crashing noise rang out from somewhere behind us, a safe distance away and yet upsettingly close. We spun around just in time to watch the historic town hall collapse into a pile of historic timbers. Barry was ahead of schedule. I ducked into what I assumed was a stealthy crouch and pushed Drilder away from the ongoing destruction, Slippery John keeping parallel pace on the other side of the barrier. When we reached the cliff edge at the top of the hill, we were afforded a slightly acrophobic bird's-eye view of Yawnbor. I needn't have worried. Barry was still occupied with the southern half of the town, most of which was already little more than an unusually large gravel driveway. The tallest remaining structure south of the clock tower was Barry's trebuchet, poking out above layers of ruins like a curious gazelle peering over tall grass. From here I could even see the Pirate's Cove, right past the town at the other side of the bay, and if I strained my undead eyes, the glint of Captain Scar's spyglass at the ship's prow, or stern, or whatever the front bit is called. "You going to send up that firebolt, then, villainous wraith?" "Seems a shame to interrupt such a peaceful evening," I muttered as another building collapsed. I waited for the cover of a suitably large demolition, then held my hand aloft and set my fingers a-waggling. "Arcanus, Inferus." I stopped. I had suddenly noticed movement on the outskirts of the town. Slippery John followed my gaze. "Hey, aren't they friends of yours?" "Oh, God, no," I whispered. Two distant figures were walking up the main road into Yawnbor, exactly the same one I had took. The first figure was wearing pigtails that looked like two guinea pigs were trying to escape from its head, and the second one was walking with its hands behind its back, pretending to have nothing to do with the first. "Hey, Slippery John thinks you might want to finish off that spell." I looked at my upraised hand just in time to see my sleeve catch fire. I snapped it off my robe and stamped on it, then stared at Merrill and the priest again. They were only blocks away from Barry's operation. I broke into a run. Then, two steps later, I broke out of it. A lot of conflicting thoughts were having a shouting argument in my head. If I couldn't reach Merrill in time, she'd stumble right into Barry, true to idiot form. But I didn't give a furious flying toss about Merrill. She was a big enough girl to take responsibility for her own stupid actions. But then I looked down at my wooden leg. I imagined myself, hundreds of years down the line, still pursuing my quest for deletion, my non-regenerating body gradually being worn down by repeated damage and wear and tear, until there was nothing left of me but half a skull dragging itself along by its eyebrow. "Slippery John wishes he could get away with your kind of indecisiveness in Slippery John's fast-paced life of adventure and peril," said Slippery John pointedly. Merrill had been the only thing holding me together since my rebirth. She might have been offensively chirpy and a rabid nationalist, but at least she knew how to sew. I ran. Slippery John remained where he was, leaning on the barrier and making comforting small talk with Drilda's indifferent carcass. By the time I reached the main road, they had already moved on into the inner suburbs. Fortunately, the priest had been scattering pamphlets on people's driveways. I followed the trail, trying to keep as quiet as possible with my new leg clacking woodenly against the cobblestones. I was passing by a cottage home with a particularly well-kept lawn and an inept attempt at topiary, when I heard noises from the adjoining street. "Just wondering if you'd seen our friend anywhere," came Merrill's voice. "You remember, thin, no nose, talks like a complete misery guts all the time."
"Yes, I remember him." Barry's voice sounded irritated. "I'm just surprised that you're coming to me about it." I hopped over the fence, My foot caught on the crossbar, and I fell on my face into the immaculate grass, turning it into an impressive stealth roll as I freed myself. Then I gathered myself up onto hands and knees and crawled past the cottage to the rear garden, where I took up position behind a conifer, gently pushing the leaves aside with one hand. I was looking out onto a street that seemed to mark the border of Barry's demolition work for the day. Every building in my field of vision had now been levelled. The timeshare holiday homes of an entire continent's middle class lay in a thin layer of shattered bricks and plaster. Barry and his squad of mercenaries were nearby, gathered around the trebuchet with their backs to me. Merrill and the priest were a few yards down the road. It was like a standoff between two miniature armies, one of which had apparently forgotten it was at war.
"It's never too late to bury the hatchet, that's what Dreadgrave taught us," said Merrill proudly.
"I remember that hatchet," muttered one of the adventurers.
"So I just wanted you to know I forgive you for trying to burn us, and ask if Jim passed through here."
Barry scratched his head. He seemed more confused than malevolent. "Well, actually, yes, he did. We had him destroyed." Merrill's smile froze.
"You what?"
"You said you destroyed him, Benjamin," said Barry to the mage in his employ. The pack of mercenaries passed around a few panicky glances. Then all of them made a brave attempt to simultaneously hide behind Benjamin.
Yes, that's right," said their reluctant spokesman. "Trapped him on the beach, blew him up. Pow! Just like we said. Nothing but ashes left."
"Yeah, and they all blew out to sea," said the
freshly resurrected northern barbarian bloke.
"And that's why there's no body, and you can totally stop thinking about it."
"We destroyed him because he defiantly refused to reveal your location," said Barry. He was trying to be triumphant about it, but Merrill's puppy dog stare and oozing tears were making him visibly uncomfortable. He gave an embarrassed cough that resounded like a thunderclap.
"So now we're going to destroy you, and you've rendered his sacrifice moot? Sorry?"
A very awkward moment of silence passed as Merrill took this in, mouth quivering.
"Behold, I have brought this minion of heresy to undergo your proper judgment," barked the priest suddenly, who knew a turning of the tide when he saw it. "May her smitation be deservedly swift, my brother in God."
"But what did we ever do to you?" said Merrill, her cheeks swelling up, and something burbling disgustingly in the back of her throat.
Barry puffed himself up, clearly preparing to deliver the same line of bullshit he'd fed me.
"I am the avatar of a divine power," he said grandly. "The undead are aberrations to his..."
His enthusiasm died, withering away against Merrill's pathetic stare, like butter under a level 60 infernal destructo blast. He turned his back on his targets. "Oh, just blast them."
"Yes, blast her,"
said the priest smugly, folding his arms and taking a step back.
"Blast both of them." "Yes, blast both of her legs," said the priest as fast as he could. "Her sinful, whorish legs."
I was waiting for Merrill to don her usual set of reality blinkers and say something chipper and blasé in the face of annihilation. She didn't. Her shoulders were slumped, and her head was hanging glumly. Her pigtails seemed to be drooping like the ears of a dog cornered by a master with a rolled-up newspaper. The moonlight shone off globules of grey viscous tears on her cheeks. Benjamin held a hand out towards her and began to twiddle like a pro.
"Arcanus, Inferus, Maxima..."
Maxima is an all-purpose word added to an incantation to amplify the spell's effect, generally to the point of leaving the caster completely exhausted for a good 10 or 20 minutes. There wouldn't be enough left of Merrill's head to spread on toast. A second passed. Suddenly, I was standing out in the street, off balance. My wooden leg had somehow found its way into my hands, which were still reverberating from an extremely powerful impact. Benjamin lay on his back, a comically large lump rising out of his hair, and arcane fire still crackling about his fingers. All eyes were upon me in a frozen tableau of surprise. The only sound was the bush behind me gently rustling back into place. Barry, who had been floating disgustedly away from the scene, stopped and spun around. Any moment now, I thought, someone is going to take the initiative and get the action going again. And it would probably be better if it were me. I crouched, grabbed Benjamin's sparking hand, and pointed it skywards. Telekus, I said. I hadn't been sure how advanced a mage Benjamin was, but judging by the power of the blast, he must have at least been a postgraduate. My vision whited out, and a deafening roar flooded my ears. My vision cleared after a few moments. Benjamin and I were unharmed, of course. It's a legal standard for spells to come pre-installed with a complex system of sub-spells that protect the caster or casters from harm. Otherwise there would have been a lot of mages running around with blackened stumps where their forearms should have been. The adventurers had taken the worst of the blast. Every single one of them was flat on their back, arms and legs protectively curled up like cockroaches, groaning like rusty garden gates. Thin columns of smoke were rising from where their hair and eyebrows had been. Merrill and the priest, who had been furthest away, were stunned but standing. Merrill snapped out of it first and ran to my side as I hastily lodged my wooden leg back into the stump with a sickening thump.
"They said you were dead!"
"I am," was the obvious response.
"They said they destroyed you!"
"Well, they didn't. Let's go!" My first instinct was to get the hell away from the scene before the adventurers could regain their senses. I had my fists clenched and one leg raised in preparation for breaking into a run, when a wall of holy white flame burst forth from the ground, surrounding us.
"You said you destroyed him," said Barry, floating into view from his hiding place behind the trebuchet. Little white sparks were bursting from his furious eyes. "Clearly you didn't, and yet you said you did. That's just not professional."
I could have run through the fire and hoped for the best. I could also hypothetically have existed with all my skin burnt off. But it still seemed like a better plan than standing and waiting for Barry to start smiting. Something crashed to the street nearby. Everyone turned to see a brick rattling to a halt on the ground. Said Barry. "Where did the sunlight go?" He looked up and was immediately answered by a piece of plaster bouncing off his nose. He opened his mouth to say something along the lines of, "Ow," when there was a horrible wet crunching sound and a hefty chunk of cornice was suddenly sitting where his head had been. Barry and his team had been working to bring down a sturdy two-story post office before Merrill's interruption, and the impact of Benjamin's blast had encouraged it to finish the job by itself. Now it was bending slowly towards the ground as if it had been punched in the gut, sprinkling loose objects and architectural features as a prelude to a spectacular collapse. "Run," I suggested, holding our arms over our heads like evening commuters caught in the rain,
Merrill, the priest, and I made it past the stricken building moments before it smashed to the ground. A great cloud of brown dust billowed out, discouraging the few adventurers who were on their feet and trying to give chase. "Weren't you in New Pillock?" I asked Merrill as we ran towards the coast. "Given up on the revolution?"
"On the contrary," she said, thrilled by my question. "The people of Beauregard have risen up. A mighty fist of guerrilla resistance swept across the land, and the reins of power were seized from the Pillock occupying forces in a historic battle by dawn."
I jogged thoughtfully in silence for a few steps, trying to process this.
"What?" "An interim government has been formed, and a new age of hope and liberty has begun. Our people's spirits have been carried through these difficult times by the stories of a man, a purebred Beauregardian, who rose from death itself to carve out a legend."
I was certain she'd been repeating that to herself the whole way here. "Please don't say you've been telling them about me."
"The stories of your exploits inspire our fighting men."
A pause. "I might have exaggerated a little, but they're really impressed with how you rose to the rank of executive rat pit administrator so quickly. Everyone wants to meet you, Jim. There's a talk of a seat in the government. You're a hero to the people."
By this point, we'd arrived back at the coast. "I already told you I don't go for the hero thing," I said distractedly, looking for an escape route.
"Oh, really? So what was all that business back there, if it wasn't leaping to the rescue?"
From somewhere behind us came the crunching of heavy adventurer boots coming across freshly created gravel. I ran into the beach and started scraping up shingle.
"That was sort of a reflex action," I said, stuffing my pockets.
"Come on, pick up some stones."
"What for?"
"We need to hide under the sea."
"Right." She stirred the pebbles uncertainly with a toe. "So what are the stones for?"
"To weigh you down."
"Oh, I see, of course. Sorry."
She turned to the priest, who was watching disdainfully with arms folded.
"We need to pick up some stones."
He sniffed. "The day I scrabble in the dust for my gratifications is..."
I looked up, just in time to see Merrill and the priest felled like bowling pins by a flying donkey before its musty flank hit me full in the face, knocking me off my feet. I spent a disoriented second struggling to push the hairy, foul-smelling mass away, before it hurtled off into the sky with a single despairing hee-haw. Benjamin the Mage walked slowly towards us, hands still raised from casting level 12 animal levitation.
"Found you," he said, with murder in his eyes.
"Barry's dead," I pointed out. "You can stop doing his bidding now."
"Oh no, you misunderstand me, old boy. Arcanus. This is entirely for me. Inferus."
Bolts of fire magic crawled up and down his firearm.
"Finishing another man's spell. By God, the cheek of it. Maxima. Is that another thing they teach you in peasant school?"
He'd gotten his magic reserves back quicker than I thought. That little cudgel-induced nap had apparently been very restful. I wondered if there was anything I could say between now and the next magic word that would cause Benjamin and I to become firm friends.
"Teller," he began, before something behind us caught his eye. "Is that a pirate ship?"
He quickly left the scene, horizontally and on the business end of a cannonball. The Black Pudding was doing a pretty good job of making the pathetic Yawnbor coastline seem epic as it creaked and ahared its way along, firing again and again at what remained of the town and Barry's cowering army. Three rowboats on the near side of the ship were steadily filling up with cutlass-waving corsairs, looking forward to a good old pillage.
"Friends of yours?" asked Merrill.
"Oh, balls," I said, quickly getting to my feet. I sprinted along the pier towards the ship, waving my hands for attention. "Stop lowering the boats!" I yelled over the cannon fire. "We have to go now!" The massive bulk of Captain Scar stepped up to the ship's prow. She held her hands to her mouth, and her equally massive voice boomed out across the water.
"Why do you always have to be such a buzzkiller?"
"Barry's dead! Barry is down! We have to go now before he gets himself resurrected!"
"What about the dragon moss?"
I thought quickly. "Turns out I had some in my pocket the whole time. Stop lowering the boats and we'll come out to you."
"Are you sure Barry's dead, matey?"
I paused on the verge of diving off the pier.
"Yes!"
My throat was beginning to feel very rough.
"Only he's looking pretty frisky to me."
Somewhere behind me, I heard the angry lurch of a slightly damaged trebuchet, followed by the sound of a heavy payload whistling through the air. I glanced up just in time to see a loose collection of half-bricks batter the Black Pudding's crow's nest, whose occupant had the presence of mind to stop waving his cutlass around and dive into the sea. Barry was alive again, his head none the worse for its ordeal. His anger had become a tangible force, crackling around him in a semi-transparent white sphere. He hissed, sparkling white energy bursting from his mouth and eyes. "Have a schedule!" A collection of heavy bricks rose unbidden from the ground and collected themselves in the trebuchet's sling. Barry waved his arm, and the trebuchet flung another payload across the bay, this time leaving the top part of the Black Pudding's midden-mast hanging at an unhealthy angle. There was a blast of cannons, and the pudding returned fire. Two cannonballs were aimed at Barry, and seemed to be dead on target, until they reached Barry's shield, whereupon they halted in mid-air and split into droplets of molten steel.
"You can't stop me!" he roared. "I have God on my side!"
I looked around for the priest, feeling certain he'd have something to say about that. He was still on the section of beach where he'd been knocked down, watching Merrill, who appeared to be desecrating Benjamin's latest corpse. I watched, baffled, as she gathered his top half into her arms and waddled towards an oblivious Barry, holding out the dead mage's still sparkling hand like some kind of handheld cannon. I swore so loud that the spiders in my lungs had to cover their children's ears, then started running back towards Merrill. I knew what she was planning, and I knew what would happen if she tried it.
"No!"
I cried, muted by another futile cannon blast, at precisely the worst moment.
"Tell a cuss,"
I heard Merrill announce, pointing Benjamin roughly in Barry's direction. Several complicated things happened, or rather, one very simple thing happened for several complicated reasons. Magic can go wrong in so many fascinating ways. You have to spend 6 months at mage school copying out the rule book before they'll even teach you the wet dog spell. It's certainly possible to cast a spell with the fresh corpse of a man who's already said most of the words, because the magic stays stored up in his body. It's just that doing so is really, really stupid. Magic is a living thing, inclined to all the same bloody-minded pettiness of other living things. And there are two things it really doesn't like. Being cast by a dead guy, properly dead, not the inferior Dreadgrave brand, and being cast by an amateur. The result of either was generally what we in the trade call a voyage to the Cock-Up Peninsula. Merrill was attempting both. By the time she finished saying the word,
I had almost reached her, so I was around just in time to take a full-scale magical blowback right in the mush. After my eyes started working again and my ears stopped ringing, I discovered that I was in the air, and the entire town was travelling away from me at great speed. I made the mistake of wondering how I'd gotten through that intact, at which point I made intimate contact with the Black Pudding's figurehead spine first. I heard a sound like a wooden ruler breaking over someone's knee, then felt my limp carcass flop down into the water. I tried to start swimming, but my limbs were obstinately refusing to respond. I floated on my back for a while, staring up at the night sky and slightly misaligned figurehead, listening to the distant sounds of Yawnbore, the crackling of massive fires, and a succession of little follow-up explosions trying to leech off the success of the first. Then I heard the splashing of an inept swimmer coming up to my side, and Merrill's face moved into view.
"Jim, are you all right?"
"My spine's broken, and I can't move. You?"
"One or two liquefied internal organs. Nothing I was really using."
"I too am once again spared that I would complete my God-given destiny," added the priest, like anyone cared.
The pirates let a rope down, so Merrill tied it around my legs, and I was hauled upside down to the deck. On the way up, I had a chance to get an inverted look at what remained of Yawnbore after the disastrous magical hissy fit. Most of the seafront buildings were burning merrily, and I hazarded a guess that the thin layer of ash and blackened body parts around the splintered remains of a trebuchet were all that remained of Barry and his crew. Perhaps he would appreciate Merrill's blunder keeping the demolition on schedule.
"So things are getting a wee bit confused," said Captain Scar after her men had laid me out on the deck. "Have you what you needed for the undeadifying? Are we killing the vicar or what?"
No, he's dead. We can get past the barrier now."
"Well, all right, then."
She made a complex hand signal, and a couple of her men rushed off to haul up the anchor.
"We'll skirt by the cliffs to pick up Slippery John and be on our way. Is there a reason why you're lying down like that?"
Merrill appeared over the side.
"Hiya,"
she said, flapping her hand madly in what was probably supposed to be a greeting. Captain Scar looked at her, then back to me.
"Who's she?"
"An associate," seemed like the most honest answer. The priest arrived next, taking a good long look down his nose at the company he was now keeping. Captain Scar sighed and folded her arms.
"Ye only ever seem to raise more and more questions, don't ye, laddie?"
said Captain Scar, rubbing her chin again.
"We're pleased as punch to be getting away from that shit old town, though, so I won't make too much of an issue of it if you hand over all your valuables and promise to look like hostages."
"Deal,"
said Merrill, rolling me onto my front and messing with my tormented robe.
"Shall we have a look at this spine, then?"
With my face flat against the splintery wooden floor, I was given chance to reflect. "Barry," I said. "He was killed when that bit of rubble fell on his head, right?"
"Probably. A bit of his brain hit me in the eye. But he came right back, is my point."
I gestured upwards with my eyebrows. "Pull me up. I need to check something." Obediently, she hauled me up by my shoulders and propped me up on the side. The sight of Barry's most recent death was getting further and further away, so I focused my magic undead vision as hard as I could. There was movement around the trebuchet's ruins. A little dust eddy was swirling, moving the ashes around. A tiny little whirlwind with an artistic leaning seemed to be engaged in creating a little ash sculpture of a man. "Shit!" I exclaimed, disturbing my lung spiders a second time. "I knew it'd be something like this! He regenerates! We have to go faster!"
"Not till we pick up Slippery John.
went Captain Scar from the main deck.
"Not much prevailing wind, anyway."
"But the barrier could come back up any sec—"
"Tally-ho!" came a voice from above us.
We were passing by the cliffs now, and Slippery John took the opportunity to leap heroically onto the deck, drilled a wheelbarrow and all.